The Yemeni army launches a missile and drone attack on Abu Dhabi and Dubai, as well as targets in Saudi Arabia, the second such retaliatory strike in a week. The U.S. tells non-essential embassy staffers to leave Ukraine, citing what it calls the threat of military action from Russia. Thousands of people on stage are rallying the U.S. Capitol against the government's anti-COVID measures, including mandatory vaccination. Welcome. The top story this hour, the Yemeni army is saying that it has launched a massive retaliatory operation against Saudi Arabia and the UAE, the two allies waging a war on the country since 2015. It says vital and sensitive targets were accurately hit with drones and missiles.
They targeted the Safra airport. They also hit the Abu Dhabi airport with a big number of ballistic missiles, Zulfiqar. They targeted facilities in the area of Dubai with a big number of drones and unmanned planes of Samad 3. Also, several military posts in the heart of the Saudi area, in the area of Shobra, and other Saudi towns with bigger numbers of Samad 1 unmanned planes and also artillery fire. They hit very sensitive areas in Jazan and Asir, also with a big number of ballistic missiles.
Well, the general said that the Yemeni army would continue their retaliatory attacks and respond to escalation with escalation. He warned foreign firms and investors to leave the UAE as the country is insecure and will be targeted as long as it continues the aggression against Yemen. Saudi Arabia and the UAE have both confirmed the retaliatory strikes but said that they intercepted the ballistic missiles. The attack comes just a week after Yemeni forces hit several targets inside Emirati soil using drones and ballistic missiles. The strikes are part of the reprisal attacks over the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen, which has killed hundreds of thousands of people and plunged the country into the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Okay, for more on this and an update, let's cross over to the Yemeni capital city, Sana'a. Our correspondent, Abdul Latif Al-Washali, is there. Abdul Latif, bring us an update.
Thank you so much. It is a legitimate threat for the Yemeni army to hit back at those killing more civilians. Saudis and Emiratis have been escalating their attacks recently, and they killed hundreds of civilians in their attacks in Sada, Sana'a, and in the other provinces. The Yemeni army is only targeting the facilities being used for military purposes. Al-Dhafra Air Base is a very important air base in the UAE. It has so many American soldiers in there, and the Yemeni army knows what it targets actually inside Saudi Arabia and the UAE. The operation called, or the second phase we can call it, of the Operation Yemen Storm, I believe we will see, of course, other operations at the same name, Yemen Storm, the third, fourth, fifth phase. They are all against Saudi and Emirati territories. It is a right for the Yemeni army to target these facilities, as Saudis and Emiratis has been escalating their attacks against Yemeni civilians. So it is a normal response or a result of the recent escalation held by the Saudi-led coalition. Attack actually did not go against any civilian facilities, whether in UAE or in the Saudi territories, but it also refuted the Saudi and the Emirati allegations that stopping or blocking the internet from Yemen will stop the drone attacks. Today we've seen maybe the largest operation so far held or launched by the Yemeni army. So we believe that the Yemeni army will absolutely keep escalating the attacks and make them wider and larger against Emirati and Saudi territories. And absolutely, the Yemenis today are really happy seeing who kills them is being targeted today by their army. So they express and they voice their support for the Yemeni army to launch further operations against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Abdul Latif, we have reports from the UAE and Saudi part that they have intercepted the missiles. Do we know, are we sure, if some of those missiles have hit the intended targets?
The Yemeni army will never announce or declare an operation unless it has been successful. We actually believe that the Yemeni army has absolutely hit these targets successfully. And we always see the Saudi leader coalition's media outlets keep talking about that. They have intercepted whether Yemeni drones or ballistic missiles. But eventually, we find out that they did not intercept any of these missiles, and they hit their targets, as we've seen in Baqiq and Khrais and all the other operations launched by the Yemeni army and announced by the spokesman of the Yemeni army. So they have absolutely to keep alleging that they have intercepted the Yemeni missiles and drones to make the maybe whoever in these territories feel safe. But I believe that Saudi Arabia, especially in the south, and the Emirati territories are not safe anymore as long as they keep attacking the Yemenis, as long as the war did not stop by Saudi Arabia and the Emiratis.
Okay, I appreciate that. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, our correspondent in Sana'a, Yemen. The United States orders the families of its diplomats in the Ukrainian capital to leave, citing what it calls the threat of military action from Russia. The State Department also authorized the, quote, voluntary departure of its non-essential embassy staff from Kiev. Washington says that all Americans should consider leaving the European country due to a continued Russian military threat to Ukraine. Now, they also call on the people to leave using all options available. The department warns U.S. citizens not to travel to Russia. Washington had previously issued the highest-level travel advisory for Ukraine. It also warned its citizens that they should not anticipate there would be U.S. government-sponsored evacuations should a war take place in Ukraine. Now, Dmitry Zolotarev is a journalist and political commentator, and we've asked him about the rising tensions over Ukraine, and here's what he had to say.
There is such thing, but it exists only in the minds of Western warmongers. There is Ukraine, there is Russia, and there are Western countries which desperately want to implement more sanctions on Russia, and they are desperately looking for pretext. So they're using Ukraine for that, because they have failed before with other pretexts. So they desperately want to stop Northern Stream 2 into Europe, and so they cannot use Europe as much as they used to do that before, so they are trying to act through Ukraine. You know, if Russia wanted Ukraine, it would have it a few years ago, because if Russia would want Ukraine now, it would get it in a day without any difficulties.
Now, thousands of people have staged a rally in the U.S. Capitol against the government's anti-COVID measures, including mandatory vaccination. Ralliers gathered on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. The crowd then headed for Lincoln Memorial, with some carrying signs reading coercion is not choice. The virus-related curbs have apparently polarized the country. Last week, the U.S. Supreme Court halted President Joe Biden's vaccine mandate for employees. Many Republican-governed states are also refusing to abide by Biden's call for Americans to wear masks, and that despite the virus surging and taking its toll on the country. The U.S. remains the worst-hit country in the world, both in terms of COVID cases and deaths. A ray of hope emerging for the end to the coronavirus pandemic, the World Health Organization's regional director for Europe says that the Omicron variant could put an end to the pandemic across the continent.
So it's plausible that the region is moving towards a kind of a pandemic endgame, not an endgame of the COVID-19, but a pandemic endgame.
Now, Hans Kluge hopes a global immunity from the virus once the surge of Omicron subsides. He says that the pandemic endgame will be achieved as soon as people get vaccinated. Other experts have expressed optimism as well. They say that the virus is shifting to an endemic, which means it is consistently present but limited to a particular region. However, Kluge warns it is still too soon to consider a COVID endemic, as the picture remains grim in Europe. The continent is grappling with a spike in cases, with some nations registering their record daily cases after the outbreak of Omicron. A large protest against COVID restrictions turns violent in Brussels. Police use water cannons and tear gas to disperse the demonstrators. Jerome Hughes reports from the Belgian capital.
Things started out peacefully on Sunday as an estimated 50,000 protesters took to the streets of Brussels in opposition to COVID-19 vaccines and the requirement to show certificates in order, for example, to eat in a restaurant or travel. However, things turned ugly as police were attacked by some of the demonstrators. Tear gas and water cannon were then deployed to break up the crowds. Prior to the clashes, we spoke to some of those in attendance.
Do you think the vaccine is dangerous?
I'm sure that it is dangerous.
There's no problem with the vaccine. If you want a vaccine, okay. But if you don't want it, please leave us be.
The European United Group, which organized the event, claims it's not anti-vax, but it certainly didn't sound that way.
To Mr. Bill Gates, we say, you might mean well with your vaccines, but we don't need them.
The data is indisputable. Lockdowns followed by vaccines when they became available are measures that have saved millions of lives. But some insist the inoculation drive is going too far.
Children shouldn't be vaccinated. We have an immune system. We shouldn't do this. This is an experiment.
For others, the booster campaign is an issue.
I had my basic vaccines because I work in healthcare. But booster after booster, it's not okay.
The 27-nation EU has a population of just under 450 million. 20% of adults are refusing to take a COVID-19 vaccine.
That is clearly a very significant minority. Epidemiologists say if they did take the jab, most of the restrictions these people are protesting against could be lifted much more quickly.
Anarchists managed to reach the offices of EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. Police are promising arrests in the coming days. The protesters are promising they will be back out on the streets here again next Sunday. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
An American senator is described as the dumbest foreign policy move, former President Trump's pullout of the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. In a tweet, Chris Murphy said that the withdrawal from the agreement was one of the most dangerous foreign policy decisions in five decades. He said that Trump went ahead with withdrawing from the accord despite opposition from some of his cabinet members. Trump unilaterally pulled out of the deal in 2018, reimposing sanctions on Iran. Ever since, Tehran has called for Washington to rejoin the accord and live up to its commitments, which include the removal of sanctions in a verifiable way. New U.S. administration under President Joe Biden has not only failed to do so, but it has continued with its predecessor's policy on Iran. Now, a year into the presidency of Joe Biden, the U.S. remains divided both as a nation and as a democracy. In this next report, we take a closer look at how Biden has failed to bring America together.
Today, on this January day, my whole soul is in this, bringing America together, uniting our people. Uniting our nation.
That was how Joe Biden laid out the path for his presidency during his inaugural address on the 6th of January 2021. It came after supporters of his predecessor Donald Trump raided the Capitol Hill in a deadly unrest because the former president refused to accept defeat and claimed an election fraud. Speaking exactly a year after he took office, Biden said he had not overpromised in his inaugural speech on what he could achieve. Yet a review of the status quo in the United States tells a different story. Back in October, a poll showed that 41% of Biden's supporters and 52% of those who voted for Trump want Republican and Democratic-led states to secede and form two new countries. The divide continues to define the American society and politics to the day. On Thursday, the U.S. Senate blocked Biden's key legislation to protect voting rights for African Americans and other minorities, especially in the Republican-controlled states. Democrats pushed the legislation amid restrictive voting in some Republican-led states, which Democrats see as a slow-motion coup to retake the White House in the next presidential election. Republican-led states also moved to restrict teaching critical race theory in schools. That's teaching students on the history of slavery and racism and how they shaped U.S. institutions and policy to ensure the dominance of white people. One such ban did actually become law in Mississippi on Saturday. The debates hark back to racial tensions triggered by the fatal shootings of African Americans, which have ignited some of the most serious social social unrest of the modern times in the U.S. A case in point in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse in November. The not guilty verdict in the trial was an affront to those who saw the teenager as a murderer, butting into a protest against racial injustice and killing two demonstrators. The ruling, however, was a gift to those who saw Rittenhouse as a right-wing patriot. Over the past year, the U.S. has also seen huge divisions among Republican and Democratic voters over such issues as the conservative-led push to restrict constitutional abortion rights, obligatory vaccination against the coronavirus, and even Democratic-led attempts to curb access to guns. These have also been key areas of political point scoring among Republicans and Democrats.
One thing I haven't been able to do so far is get my Republican friends to get in the game of making things better in this country. I did not anticipate that there'd be such a stalwart effort to make sure that the most important thing was that President Biden didn't get anything done. Think about this. What are Republicans for? What are they for?
Deep divides have always been there among Democrats and Republicans and their supporters, but the Capitol Hill insurrection seems to have radicalized things. Trump continues to enjoy backing from Republicans after he triggered the insurrection by the claim that Biden won the election by vote rigging. This has polarized American politics more than ever before. The insurrection has also sent reverberations through the American society, dividing people across political and racial lines.
That's all for this broadcast.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This is my flask. Some dates. A warm jacket. It might be colder. And this is my woolen hat. You know, I'm a type of person who is sensitive to cold. Now, let me zip up the backpack. Done. You might be curious to know where I'm going to visit today, yeah? Actually, it's not a far-off place. Today, I'm going to visit a part of the beautiful nature of Tehran. Yes, Sorkh Hisar Park. I promise it would be a brief but enjoyable visit. Stay with me. Sorkh Hisar is one of the national parks of Iran, which is located east of Tehran, with an area of about 9,168 hectares. Except its northeastern part, all parts of this district is under the protection of the Environment Organization. The National Park of Sorkh Hisar is one of the oldest protected zones of the world and dates back to the Qajari era. In the past, Sorkh Hisar used to be one of the oldest hunting areas of Iran and enjoyed a special status. It was during the rule of Agha Muhammad Khan Qajar that Jajrud region was chosen as a hunting place, and during the rule of Fath Ali Shah Qajar, the entire regions of Jajrud and Sorkh Hisar were recognized as hunting places. This park was registered as a national park in 1980. The weather in Sorkh Hisar is half dry, and the difference of temperature between day and night is high. Jajrud River flows in this region, and after passing through the Latian Dam, flows in the marginal parts of the region, and then spills into Parchin Township and leaves off. This park is created from meadows, hills, and heights, which are as high as 1,220 to 2,147 meters. I am now at Sorkh Hisar Park. What a clean air! In front of me, just far away from me, those hills are blanketed with snow. However, in this part which I'm standing, there is no snow, but it's so cold. I'd better wear my gloves. Sorkh Hisar Park has diverse flora. There are different types of trees, bushes, shrubs, and herbs in this park. Some of these herbs have medicinal effects, and there are also rare types of herbs in this region, which are unfortunately on the verge of becoming extinct. Tell you an interesting fact. Sorkh Hisar has two types of flora. One type, which has plants of hot regions, including tamarisk, milkvetch, and wild rue. And the other type, which has steppe-like plants, including thymes, zizifora, and pennyroyal. Though, there is no trace of these herbs here because of the cold. If it wasn't a cold season, I would pick some zizifora for my grandma. She loves it in her tea. Oh, the sound of these birds is very beautiful. I can recognize some of these sounds. Though, there are many types of birds here. There is heron, hawk, bitterns, even vulture in here. Sorkh Hisar has also a diverse fauna and is indeed the treasury of Iran's environment. Thank you. well, Sorja Hazar, beside its great nature, has many facilities to entertain you. Here, there is a cycling route. Good job! And also, there is a road for those who like to hike in the nature. On my right, there is a sports complex, which has facilities for sports like tennis, paintball, billiards, darts, and shooting. And here, there is also a theme park for children. In this park, children can have fun and at the same time, get educated about the culture of traffic. And there is a pergola here, which sells tea and coffee. Drinking a cup of Iranian tea in this weather really hits the spot. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. I'm Kavitat Wave. The U.S. confrontation with Russia continues unabated, and it appears not all European countries are in sync or in step with U.S. moves when it comes to the nuclear power nation. Germany has said that it will not supply Kiev with weapons for now, something which has drawn the anger from Ukraine. Is it because of Nord Stream 2 gas pipeline? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will examine why Germany has taken a different approach than the warmonger U.S., and if this split is true among other European nations. We will also take a look at whether the U.S.'s ultimate goal is to destabilize Central Asian countries in order to prevent, as they see it, Russia's expansionist aspirations. All right, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. We have Vladimir Goldstein. He's an associate professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University, who joins us from Providence, Rhode Island. Also joining us, Urs Unkopf, Government Relations Director at BWA, who joins us from Berlin.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
I'd like to welcome both of you gentlemen, and I'm going to start with you, Urs Onkov, if I may. When it comes to Russia vis-a-vis Ukraine, what are we looking at when it comes to the U.S. position? It seems like it's pretty clear that it wants to provide arms to not only the Baltic states, if I'm correct to say that, and it also has NATO doing its military maneuvers, moving eastward and putting pressure on Russia. I mean, at this point, we're looking at the latest that we have of U.S. arms delivery, 90 tons of U.S. military aid, part of the $200 million, from what I'm reading here, of lethal aid, which is part of the $2.5 billion delivered so far. I can get into some of the details behind this. What are we looking at when it comes to this massive military injection when it comes, and it's emanating from the U.S. mainly here?
Good evening. Thank you for the question. So I think it is quite clear that the Biden administration and President Biden don't want to risk an immediate open war. That is why those discussions on arms delivery and all those preparatory measures are now pushed forward in the U.S. It is quite clear that Ukraine is not a NATO member, and in the Baltic states there are totally different conditions, different frameworks applying. Let me also add from the German point of view, the recent days there has been widely discussed in the German media the statement of the now former head of the German Navy, which was definitely not helpful for the debate. I think at the moment and at this phase of the conflict where we have now arrived, it is the most important task of every politician to de-escalate in every way. That means de-escalation on the military as well as in the political level, and also important on the level of public discourse. The German Foreign Minister, Annalena Baerbock, has clearly stated during her recent visit to Moscow and during the meeting with the Russian Foreign Minister, Sergei Lavrov, that Germany is not going to deliver arms into conflict zones, and that has also been confirmed towards the Ukrainian Foreign Minister, Dmytro Kuleba. So it is quite clear that Germany will try to use its position to negotiate and to get all the relevant stakeholders, involved parties, back to the negotiation table, because this is the most important in this situation to prevent an open war.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting that you have that take on this, and I'm going to ask you, Vladimir Goldstein. Our guest there from Berlin says that it doesn't seem like there's going to be a war scenario that's going to pan out of this. I'm looking at deliveries of U.S.-made Stinger shoulder-launched anti-aircraft missiles to Kiev. I'm looking at the U.K. Let me go down the list, who has delivered a small number of anti-armor defensive weapon systems. I mean, if it smells like war, it looks like war, it looks like it's going to be a war. What do you think? Do you think that this is the scenario set for war or not?
Well, I think it's we all know in the real world things can happen. And potentially, of course, it can lead to the war. But I don't think there is interest in terms of the war, neither on the Russian side, nor on the Ukrainian side, nor on the European side. Of course, you know, it's in the interest of the United States and probably, England is somehow to create this appearance of danger, appearance of trouble, but they are definitely pursuing their own interests. There is interest of American military-industrial complex. You know, they're very active. They like to sell their weapons. There are interests of some industry sector. They are not very much interested in Russia trading with, Germany. They prefer Germany and other European countries dealing, with the United States, gas companies and oil companies. So they pursue their own interests. But, you know, there are endless amount of reports, including BBC and many other people, that people neither in Russia nor in Kiev feel imminent war. They know that this is just, saber-rattling talk, people pursuing their own political agendas. And, this is a very good example of German Navy chief, Schoenbach, who said that this is all kind of, the war is not happening, and the idea with Crimea is over, let's move forward, let's have pragmatic discussion. However, he was immediately forced to retire. So in other words, the United States pushes this program pursuing its military and economic interests, which lie not from the war, they benefit not from the war, but from fear-mongering and war-mongering and the stuff, and splitting Germany from Russia. That's another very important dimension.
Aha. Uh-huh. So you saved the best for last. I appreciate that. Urs Unkopf, are we looking at that? Are we looking at the fact that you have, and you're in Berlin, that Germany is standing up, and as you said, they want to see if this can be worked out. They're taking the diplomatic approach. This is said to be a first major test for the Social Democrat. Scholz, also that German politicians understand Russia, so to speak, and that understanding remains alive, which is why there's a push for this to be taken down a notch or two, or even more. But is it true what our guests there said? Is there also a push somehow for Germany to be separated from Russia? Because Germany obviously is a major player in this whole scheme when it comes to European countries.
That's a very interesting question, and I would agree with many of the points my colleague mentioned so far. Of course, there are interest groups which try to push Germany back from Russia into a one-sided position towards Ukraine. But first and overall, Germany needs to align its foreign policy with its national interests. And our national interests do neither 100% comply with the Russian position nor 100% with the Ukrainian position. So that is also why the German business community, and so far also the politics during the era of Angela Merkel, has, for example, separated business relations from political relations. And it is also in our interest to develop good relations with Ukraine, but also on the same time to maintain those relations with Russia. Russia is one of the most important suppliers for oil and gas for Germany. Russia has fulfilled all its commitments in this sphere. And there have been various statements from different stakeholders that if the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which is technically ready to operate, also will be put into operation, it will not be a shutdown of a gas transit, natural gas transit through Ukraine. Mm-hmm. So all those questions needs to be discussed on a rational level. And once again, I would like to underline, we need to de-escalate and to put out the tension of this debate at the moment.
Sure. Well, you had one courageous Navy chief from Germany, Vladimir Goldstein, to stand up. He said it was nonsense to think that Russia was about to invade Ukraine, and that also, praising in a sense, the Russian President Vladimir Putin, said that he deserves respect. And then he went on to resign. The fact that he says it's nonsense goes flat against what the U.S. stance is. And, of course, the U.S. has pulled other countries to believe that Russia is going to invade. Is it nonsense, Russian invasion theory?
I think it is nonsense. The problem is that professionals, be it, real academics, real military people, German Navy have the intelligence sources. They know that very well. They can sense the mood in Ukraine, in Russia. There is no mood for war. So he just says something which kind of makes sense and based on reality. However, what I would want to stress is the amount of propaganda which one sees in British TV, in American TV, is mind-staggering. I left Russia and the Soviet Union in the 70s, and even then it wasn't such unified voice condemning this, pronouncing this, making all this kind of unified. God forbid that there is some dissent note. The same thing is just now orchestrated by United States propaganda. So somebody who makes sense out of the blue declared a pariah, and told to resign. But sooner or later, you know, there is what is important, that Germany is an economic powerhouse. They have their interests. They have their traditions. You know, Russia and Germany, what, you know, of course they were in the wars, but they were trading, they were partners. There's endless amount of cultural, political, philosophical exchanges. So these two countries are more or less have to trade with each other and have to function. And they are located very close to each other in Europe. So why not United States and England, which is also very far from the Central Europe, interfere and play their geopolitical games at the expense, I want to underline, at the expense, not Ukraine. Ukraine can find their way negotiating, de-escalating, like you know, my colleague said, and Ukraine can function too. But they should promote American interest in the heart of Europe, because for the time being, that's what Ukraine is doing.
Well, maybe it's a good time for us to try to summarize very briefly, if you can, Ursulkov, why it is that Russia has been demonized by the U.S., not only demonized, but also cited as a national security threat. We can go back to when they said that they meddled in the U.S. elections, but of course Ukraine was the tipping point. Why do you think that Russia is on the target of the U.S. or the radar of the U.S. to such extreme?
Well, of course, it's a geopolitical competition where we see at the moment mainly three players, the U.S., China, and Russia. And also interesting is the second part of the statement of this former German Navy chief. He mentioned that we should align stronger with Russia in order to contain China. And one, we have to understand that it is not in our interest as a power in the center of Europe, as one of Europe's strongest players, as Germany, to play Russia against China. Nor is it not in our interest to play the U.S. against Russia. And I hope that Germany in the course of this year will reset multilateral dialogue formats. Germany currently holds the presidency of the G7, which also could make a step towards Russia, towards retaking the dialogue. But at the moment, I see that we need to put out the tension of the public discourse to avoid a situation like we had before the First World War. Before the First World War started, every media, every newspaper was writing about the war and the possibility of war. And if we just talk about war and not how to avoid the war, then the war in the end will come. And this needs to be prevented with all possible forces from all stakeholders.
Well, it also, there needs to be a reminder here, which many may seem to have forgotten because it's going back to such a long time ago, Vladimir Goldstein, and that is the fact that Ukraine has mainly not been fighting Russian armed forces in the Donbas region. People don't seem to really realize that. And you know, yes, you know, Russia may have trained or may have armed them, but they're not doing the fighting. Russia's military involvement might be more so, if anything, on the advisory part of this, which led to the separation. I mean, isn't that something that needs to be highlighted so people who are involved in this, any of the players, realize, you know, this is not Russian direct involvement.
That's absolutely the case. You know, what we know from the very recent history is, you know, Eastern Ukraine, Donbas region, were rather sympathetic to Kyiv until 2014, when, you know, they were demonized, they were immediately called separatists, traitors, blah, blah, blah. And now, recent polls conducted by Kyiv suggest that, you know, people in Donbas don't want to be part of Kyiv regime. So what we have a very serious civil tension. So people in Donbas are Russian speakers. They are Russian, you know, culturally, while Kyiv want to subjugate them, not give them autonomy, not allow them to be their own choice. They want to subjugate them. They bombard them. They kill civilians. So far, 14,000 people were killed on all sides, but a lot of civilians. So it plays very bad in Russia, you know, because Russians feel that this is their Russian brothers. Furthermore, quite, you know, during recent times, many of the people in this Donbas region got their Russian passport. So they're technically Russians too. This is, of course, a complicated geopolitical game the countries play. But, you know, you have to be aware that Russia have to protect these people on eastern Donbas. So what's important is for everyone to sit at the table and discuss. But what we see that Ukraine prefers to hide that too. They prefer to talk and blame Russians. They prefer to get American aid. They prefer to play British aid. They prefer to claim victims while, you know, they haven't solved even, you know, situation in their own territory. They didn't solve it yet. So, you know, why on earth this country, which cannot solve, you know, their own problems, dictate Germany, mm-hmm. you know, United States, Russia, Canada, what to do? It's a really big unanswered question.
There was an interesting statement that came from the U.S. President, Usunkov, just days ago, and I'd like to find out from you what you thought of it, even though he retracted that statement, and he said that a small-scale Russian invasion of Ukraine might not lead NATO to respond with full force the way that he was describing it. And that really ticked off Ukraine, and it took many by surprise. Again, scrambled to take back that statement. But do you think that that is something that the U.S. Actually means, that it's okay, if it even turns out to be that way, that a small-scale incursion by Russia is something that the U.S. or NATO would tolerate?
Well, I think this statement once again shows how tense the situation is, but realistically, I think that U.S. would risk a war, which would be, in every case, a nuclear war with Russia about Ukraine. It's more about to underline how the frontiers are at the moment, and I think that it is quite obvious that Putin is a strategist and he knows quite well how far he can go. The same applies for the Biden administration. So there needs just to be defined their faces, where both could agree on a certain format of negotiations. It might be the Minsk group, but we should also be open for new formats to find a constructive solution.
All right, let's look at this from a vantage point that's not just about war and the possibility of it. Vladimir Goldstein, we know what had happened in Ukraine. The U.S. pretty much came out and said it was involved in the color revolution. They like colors. There was a revolution there. I think it was called purple for that color. I forget. Maybe you can tell us. So based on that, what color was it?
Orange,
I'm sorry. Okay, so you have that execution by the U.S., which stirred up the country, and some are suggesting, some analysts, that that's what the U.S. is actually after, Central Europe and the European countries that maybe were in the sphere of Russia, to create some kind of instability, Kyrgyzstan being the latest example, and this would then be a bulwark against Russia to prevent Russia from wanting to expand in their eyes. Do you think that that is the case?
Yeah, that's the case. You know, what we have to remember that after collapse of the Soviet Union, Russia was kind of very weak and very weak on the international space. So United States believed that they can sort of call all the shots. So they, you know, play their games with Europe. They expanded NATO. And, you know, it worked very well in their favor, and they want to continue this way. So obviously when Russia becomes more self-assertive, it's already kind of a threat. So they are, you know, using that. But also in terms of geopolitics, we do have to remember that Europe is Europe. And this is very, you know, if we have EU and Russia, and, you know, after all, China wants to trade there. If this is a very powerful bloc, trading together, working together economically, then United States is actually odd man out. They can be somewhere trading with Latin America, but they'll be kicked out of Europe because they're not placed there. They're geographically, they're not located. So they don't want to accept it. They want to stay in Europe. So I think this, you know, this certain Eastern European countries like Poland, Baltics, and Ukraine are their foothold, and they will do everything to protect it, which, you know, works, A, they preserve American interests, and B, due to geographical location of Ukraine, it is precisely the place, you know, Ukraine and Poland, they separate Russia and Germany from, you know, getting a very, you know, consistent economic relationship, which has, you know, been all the time. If you look at the history, you just mentioned First World War. One of the ideas, you know, there were negotiations between Russia and in Germany, they wanted to work together, but for England, it was absolute sort of taboo. So they did all they could to set up Russia against Germany, and I think that's a pretty successful strategy of Anglo, you know, sphere to somehow to keep these two countries very separate from each other, because it's in their interest.
All right. So since we're drawing down with the time here, Urs Unkopf, you know, it should all come down to the economy. And I'm looking at the point of view of Germany, looking at the situation, and even other European countries. When they, if they're going to be pressured by the U.S., I'm sure the question comes about, so what will we gain by going against Russia? Is the U.S. pressuring these countries with economic incentives to go against Russia, even though Russia, as I'm sure you're well aware, not only is a very big supplier of a variety of goods for Germany, perhaps, but in the bigger picture, for Europe and the European Union. So how can the U.S. pressure these countries to go against Russia?
We had such a situation already when some senators from the Republicans announced that they would sanction all companies directly or indirectly working on the Nord Stream 2 project. But the German economy in general has a strong commitment in Russia as well as in Ukraine. And also our association has a reliable partner in both countries. So the German economy needs to define its own interests. And that can only be that we can continue with stable and good businesses in this region. Russia is a very important traditional partner since the 1970s. Russia delivers a significant share of Germany's energy consumption. Mm-hmm. However, there has been a common European effort in Ukraine within the last years, especially in regional developments, and also those efforts should not be taken off. So I think in a mid to long-term perspective, also economic relations could help to build new bridges when politics find fail to find a common ground of speech. The economy can build new bridges.
Well, that's a hope there. And to round this off, Vladimir Goldstein, when you have the U.S. as our guest there just mentioned, and I think this happened not too recently, but it was very recent, Republican lawmakers in the U.S. saying that threatening Germany with sanctions if they were to have companies work on the Nord Stream 2. In essence, they're saying, let your customers pay double, triple the price for gas, but no, you shouldn't work on the project. So how does the U.S. look when it exerts that type of pressure on Germany?
Well, U.S. doesn't look, very good. And I think what we have to be aware that, Merkel was a very experienced politician with, very stable relationship with the United States. And she probably could push things back, when crazy American senators trying to gain some popularity at home would pronounce some idiotic propositions like, extra sanctions. She could push back. I think now United States want to try this new leadership of Germany and see how how resistant they will be. But there's nothing wrong in United States trying. That's their interest. They are more than happy to promote their own sort of companies. Sure. They are more than happy to let Ukraine still be in the center of gas transportation. So Ukraine, by the way, somebody calculated 18% of their economy depends on the money they get from this old pipeline, so they did. So that's where Americans will be pushing, and I think it's up to Europeans to resist it and convince Americans that we everybody has their own interest. Not the world is not reduced to Washington and American interest.
Thank you so much. We're fresh out of time. Vladimir Goldstein, many thanks for your contribution. Associate Professor of Slavic Studies at Brown University from Providence, Rhode Island, and Urs Unkopf. Thank you. Government Relations Director at BWA from Berlin. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikovit Tarve, the entire team, it's goodbye. Until next time.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This man changed the world.
Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar. Allahu Akbar, Khomeini Rahbar.
Our bosses couldn't cope with the idea of an 80-year-old Ayatollah, which they didn't even know what an Ayatollah was, who lived on garlic and onions and yogurt, directing a revolution that was about to topple America's most important ally.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, in the name of Allah, the Exalted, the Most Compassionate, the Most Merciful. Salam, hello and welcome to our audience, and particularly a warm welcome to our listeners to our program, The Man Who Changed the World. This is a program dedicated to the memory of Imam Khomeini, may God bless his great soul, and I'm your host on this program, Ijaz Hussain. Once again, I'm joined by my good friend and expert guest, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, on this program. I'd like to say salam to him and welcome him to this program.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you very much, sir, for being with us once again and accepting our invitation. Sir, we are going to speak about unity.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Imam Khomeini, may God bless his soul. I remember some very beautiful things that he was saying about, you know, the unity of the ummah.
Mm-hmm.
And he was talking about, you know, not being Sunni or Shia, but being Muslim. And, you know, going to each other's mosques and being with each other, praying with each other. We even see that in Iraq even today. That they are, you know, because of the violence from the Takfiris, we even see the Sunnis and Shias now even praying together and being martyred together.
Exactly.
In the mosques. You know, these horrible car bombs that go off in Baghdad. You know, we are seeing that all the time. These horrific scenes where Muslims are being slaughtered during prayer, which you know, leaves one, you know, wondering, you know, exactly, you know, what's going on, but. The Imam, as I say, may God bless his great soul, emphasized this unity a great deal, and we see the need for this unity every day and every moment. So, Dr. Mahdi Tarabi, without further ado, I leave the stage entirely to you to give us your take on that.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, what you mentioned is exactly, you know, the important point, which is that you have an Islamic leader with all those things that we've talked about so many times, and
that's
all
right.
Those important matters, both religiously and also politically and globally. And one of his main points and one of the things that he emphasizes repeatedly is Islamic unity.
Yes.
Now, this is a man who is a, as we've mentioned many times before, a clergy and a scholar and somebody who is completely and 100% coming out of the school of Ahlul Bayt.
Yes.
So one might think, if one doesn't really know the school of Ahlul Bayt, or if one doesn't know a person like
very
Imam,
good point, yes,
well, he should be, you know, a prime candidate for, you know, causing problems.
Causing problems, yes. And as we've seen in other traditions.
And,
yes,
you know, being very hostile towards other Islamic denominations.
True.
And yet,
he didn't do that.
He does the opposite of that. He calls for Islamic unity.
Wonderful.
Because there's two aspects of that.
Please.
Of what he did. This is my analysis of it. Of course, sure. I'm sure there might be other analyses of why he was doing it. My analysis is that one was that it came out of the school of Ahlul Bayt, because we see that during the time of the presence of the Imams,
excellent,
they never try to
divide
the Ummah.
They never did.
That even in the worst conditions, even when the Khulafa were killing them and their families,
that's right,
they tried to maintain
the unity of the Ummah.
Okay?
Very good.
And they realized that this is of, you know, supreme importance.
Of course.
And there's no point in, you know, the Ummah breaking up and, you know, different denominations
or different groups
fighting each other and setting up rival this and that.
No.
So it comes directly, as everything with Imam,
sure,
out of the example and the Sunnah of the Prophet and, you know, the Imams,
sure,
of maintaining, you know, that unity. The second aspect of it is really this complete and total political astuteness and cleverness that Imam always had.
Yes. The wisdom that we were talking
about
before.
He was complete, and I'm talking about politically.
Yes.
You know, I mean, he had the greater wisdom, but he was also an extremely clever politician in terms of understanding tactically and strategically what needs to be done at what point.
Point, yes.
I would just want to make a little reference to another subject just to prove my bigger point.
Please do, yes.
many people at the time of the revolution were insisting that the imperial army, that the Iranian army that was part of the Shah's regime, should be dissolved.
Right.
An imam stood firm like a rock, saying it